in February, I spent a weekend in Vrindavan. So I spent something like 18 hours discussing the teachings of Queen Kunti, chapter 8 of Canto 1. And it was ecstatic. And so now, that was just before our GBC meeting, which wasn't exactly ecstatic. It was... But a little sandwich, I was thinking the chapter that follows teachings of Queen Kunti is the passing of Grandfather Bhishma and Bhishma Dev's wonderful instructions. And so that's the theme that we're going to be covering while I'm visiting here in Hyderabad. A little bit of background. Somebody do something with those children. Tomorrow, the Sunday, for the Sunday feast lecture, I'll be discussing, for the benefit of the audience there that comes, just who is Grandfather Bhishma. From the Bhagavatam point of view, the greatest glorification of Grandfather Bhishma is to say he's an unalloyed devotee of the Supreme Lord. Just like our morning discussion in the morning Bhagavatam class, Brahma is creating different entities from his body and from his navel. He produces the pitris and the sadhyas, and they have subtle bodies, and it's anyway, it describes the process of shraddha for delivering forefathers or ancestors that may be stuck somewhere without being able to continue on in their spiritual journey of life because they don't have a gross body to work with. And so shraddha ceremony is to provide the opportunity for them to once again accept a body so that they can continue with their spiritual activities. And the point that Prabhupada makes very clearly from the Bhagavad perspective is that one who's engaged in devotional service doesn't need to do those karmakanda rituals. The benefit is already included. The purpose of the ritual is just to bhoktaram jagatapasam, to satisfy the Supreme Lord. One whose whole life is dedicated to serving the Supreme and pleasing the Supreme Lord, it's already done. Your whole life is that. You don't need a ritual. Your whole life is that. And similarly, on Sunday, we're going to hear some descriptions found in Mahabharata of Grandfather Bhishma's position as it's mentioned also in this canto, he's one of the 8 Vasus. We'll hear some more about that. But in the 3rd canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, we also hear Lord Krishna addressing Uddhava as O Vasu, indicating in the purport, Prabhupada explains that Uddhava was also one of the Vasus. But we normally don't think of Uddhava as one of the Vasus. We think of Uddhava as the most elevated devotee of Krishna outside of Vrindavan. Many pure devotees. Amongst the many pure devotees, the most intimate and elevated and exalted and confidential of all Krishna's pure devotees is Uddhava. That's how we think of Uddhava. So on Sunday, for the audience that doesn't understand that, will be explaining how he's one of the Vasus. It's nice narration. But those of you that are attending the class this evening, you'll understand when I get to the point, after explaining all of that, the real glory of Grandfather Bhishma is he's a pure devotee of the Lord. And that's not a small thing. Not only he's a pure devotee of the Lord, some of the other glories of Bhishma Dev, according to Yamaraj, he's one of the 12 Mahajans. Mahajans? Great personalities. Those authorities who, through the whole history of existence, are known universally to be the final word on any subject matter. Mahajano yena katha sapantha. Maharaj Yudhisthira states this in Mahabharata to the Yaksha, when asked by the Yaksha who came from the lake, how do you understand the complexities of Dharma? They're so intricate and difficult. How does one determine what is proper, what is not proper to be done? Maharaj Yudhisthira confirmed, yes, it's true. The laws of Dharma are so complex. It's only possible by following the indications of the Mahajans. Otherwise, it's too bewildering. And in Mahabharata, when Draupadi was dragged brutally by her hair into the assembly of the Kauravas after the gambling in which she was lost, Draupadi asked a question that even Bhishma couldn't answer. The question she wanted to know the answer to was, when Yudhisthira and the Pandavas were engaged in this gambling, he had already lost everything. So, was he in a position to gamble me or not? And she asked it many times. And Bhishma said, I don't have an answer. Because if one gives an answer, it must be definitive. Unequivocally definitive and final. And he couldn't give an answer. It's too complex. Simple question. She never got an answer. The way the whole thing was resolved was, finally, Dhritarashtra broke down and said, Draupadi, this has gone too far. You just say what some desire you want fulfilled and I'll fulfill it. And her desire was that my husband Yudhisthira should be released from this loss in the gambling, loss of He should be released from bondage as being the slave of the Kauravas, or the property of the Kauravas. He said, that's done. Ask for another benediction. Then my other four husbands also, they should be released from this. That's done. Ask for a third one. She said, no. It's not proper to ask for three benedictions. Two is enough. Their own virtue will establish what is correct and proper in the future. But Bhishma was unable. And better if you're unable to say that. It's part of being a Mahajan. One doesn't know. You I don't know. I cannot say. Rather than bluffing. So he's a Mahajan. For us, all of us seated in this room, when Bhishma speaks, that's it. If we want to understand what scripture means and what Krishna means and what this means and that means, when Bhishma says, that's it. Conclusive. End of search. One just accepts. He's in that position. He's in that position because of his pure devotion, because of the intensity and the degree of his pure devotion. he understood, because of that intensity and purity of devotion, he understood Krishna perfectly well. And he was in ecstasy at the Rajasuya Yaga to declare loudly and boldly before everybody who Krishna really is. And he didn't hold back. He said it all. And the devotees were in ecstasy. And Shishupal was fried. Worse than fried. He was going crazy. And when Shishupal began speaking the opposite, blaspheming Krishna, Bhima, hand on his sword, was ready to finish Shishupal in little pieces. Bhishma stopped him. Krishna stopped him too, just raising his hand, but Bhishma gave words and stopped him. Bhima accepted Bhishma. Bhima accepted his brother by religious principle, his elder brother, and by Bhishma, by spiritual authority, even more powerful, more forceful than the codes of Dharma, are the codes of spiritual value, spiritual qualification. So there's lots of wonder and mystery surrounding Grandfather Bhishma because he did things that we wouldn't expect a pure devotee to do. He fought on the side against the Pandavas. In other words, he apparently opposed the will of Krishna. Because it was Krishna's will that the Kurukshetra battle be fought. But he fought on the side of those who Krishna wanted destroyed. Why didn't he fight on the side of what Krishna wanted? He's a pure devotee, right? Why didn't he do that? Why didn't he stop Dushasana from trying to disrobe Draupadi? Who cares what principle? Don't let somebody do that. Prabhupada explains, it was the will of Krishna to show that whoever you may be, you may even be a Mahajan, you may be somebody as exalted as Grandfather Bhishma, the protection of women is neglected, you'll be destroyed. Krishna wanted to show that. Just like Krishna put Arjuna into a state of bewilderment so that he could instruct Arjuna, so that he could instruct us, because we're in a state of bewilderment. Krishna placed Grandfather Bhishma in that position where neglect of religious principle, particularly neglect of protection of women, finished. Bhishma, who previously was such a powerful, we'll discuss this on Sunday if we have enough time. He was so powerful that he defeated Lord Parashuram in battle. Parashuram, an incarnation of the Supreme Lord who killed all kings 21 times throughout the country, throughout the whole of the land. He couldn't defeat his own disciple. That same Bhishma was put to rest at his bed of arrows by neglecting this principle of failing to protect Draupadi at a time when he should have and could have, but he didn't. Finished. So Krishna likes to bring attention to his devotee and to instruct through his devotee. And he did that in the case of Bhishma, certainly by giving Bhishma the qualification to speak great orations, and this other way also. But this chapter 9, of the first canto, Krishna's pulling a role reversal. The scene, the beginning of chapter 9, is where Bhishma is passing from this world. Let's go through the chronology of it. When was Bhagavad Gita spoken? We have Gita Jayanti every year, and it comes, depending upon the solar calendar, lunar calendar, sometime in late December. And then the Kurukshetra battle took place just after the Gita was spoken. How long did the Kurukshetra battle take? How many days? And so, shortly after the Kurukshetra battle, the soldiers that were on the battlefield were, the funeral was, arrangements were made for them. Maharaj Yudhisthira was enthroned as king. And then back to the scene of the battle, Grandfather Bhishma was still lying there. And then shortly after that, after speaking and pacifying Maharaj Yudhisthira, Grandfather Bhishma passes on Makara Sankranti, right? When the Uttarayana, when the sun starts passing in the northerly direction, the southerly direction changes to the northerly direction. You all know that one, right? The sun moves on its ecliptic path. During half of the year, it starts in the northern hemisphere and moves across the equator towards down into the southern hemisphere, and then it moves in the northerly direction, starting Makara Sankranti, passes the equator, the equinox, and goes into the summer solstice. Then starts in the southern direction again. Grandfather Bhishma was so exalted that by the benediction of his father, he did not have to die unless he chose to die. And by the time his body was finished, he chose to die. But only because he chose to die. That means he had such capacity, such a yogi. And we'll see from reading the chapter. He's a great devotee, but he also is a great yogi. Very powerful. And even in the presence of Krishna, Krishna wanted to pacify Maharaj Yudhisthira. Vyasadeva, Narada Muni, Krishna himself couldn't pacify Yudhisthira. But Bhishma could pacify Yudhisthira. Krishna likes placing his devotee in a position above himself. He only does that when there's pure devotion. Because those that are not pure in devotion wouldn't be able to process that properly. Those that are pure in devotion, they understand this is Krishna's glory. They don't become proud. They understand this is Krishna's glory. And because it brings Krishna pleasure, they accept. Because it brings Krishna pleasure. In many cases with the Pandavas, Krishna took the subordinate position. The Pandavas, as well as Grandfather Bhishma, understood Krishna's position. Prabhupada said, when Krishna was on the planet, it's not that everybody understood who Krishna was. Maybe a couple of a handful, he went like this, maybe a couple of a handful of people understood. And then he listed the Pandavas, Kunti, Bhishma, Uddhava, and a few others. But most people, when they saw Krishna, they saw Krishna. They didn't know. They didn't have a proper understanding. Bhishma knew. And so when Krishna showered glory upon Grandfather Bhishma, he understood this is Krishna's greatness. This is Krishna's kindness. This is Krishna's mercy. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. is Krishna conscious. Accepted whatever Krishna wanted because it was pleasing to Krishna. So, hearing the glories of a pure devotee and hearing the words spoken by a pure devotee, that's our project for purification and for awakening our own dormant Krishna consciousness, drawing our attention to the position of pure devotion. Krishna will be pleased when he hears his pure devotees being glorified. So that's our objective. Krishna should be pleased by this time we spend together. So chapter 9, the passing away of Bhishma Dev in the presence of Lord Krishna, begins this way. Text 1. Sutta Goswami said, being afraid for having killed so many subjects on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, Maharaj Yudhisthira went to the scene of the massacre. There, Bhishma Dev was lying on a bed of arrows, about to pass away. At that time, all his brothers followed him on beautiful chariots drawn by first-class horses, decorated with gold ornaments, as the horses and the chariots. With them were Vyas and rishis like Domya, the learned priest of the Pandavas, and others. O sage amongst the Brahmanas, this is Sutta speaking to the Shonaka and the other sages. Lord Sri Krishna, the personality of God, had also followed, seated on a chariot with Arjun. This time he wasn't the chariot driver, he was in the back seat. Thus King Yudhisthira appeared very aristocratic, like Kuvera, surrounded by his companions, the Gulyakas. Now, Prabhupada explains, when he described this section of the Bhagavatam, the Pandavas were raised by Grandfather Bhishma like he was their father. Because Pandu had died when they were still young, and Pandu was making his residence in the forest. Madri entered into the funeral pyre of Pandu, and Kunti took the five sons back to the royal palace. They had no father. So, Grandfather Bhishma, and to a large extent also Vidura, Uncle Vidura, served as the surrogate father for the Pandavas. He trained them. He cared for them. He protected them. He loved them. He was like their father. So, Grandfather Bhishma. And they knew his heart. Naturally, you associate intimately with someone, you know their heart. And the heart of Grandfather Bhishma was love for Krishna. And they also had love for Krishna. And Bhishma knew that Krishna wanted the Pandavas to rule. So it was very difficult for him to be on this other side, because he was the upholder of religious principle on a religious principle, not on the principle of, well, I'll explain this later. On religious principle, because he was not going to be king, because he had taken a vow to not become married and to not become king. Although, to not become king, he was royal order, so he was maintained by the king as if he was king. But he wasn't king. But because he was maintained by the king, he was obliged to be on the side of his maintainer, the religious principle. That's why he fought on the side of the Kauravas. When Vidura was insulted by Duryodhan, he took his bow. He was maintained in the royal family, although he was born of the maidservant of Ambika, and he was married to a maidservant woman. So he was in that caste as a Shudra. He had bow and arrow. He was insulted by Duryodhana. He took his bow and arrow, placed it by the side of the door and walked, feeling greatly relieved. This is great. Because had a battle ensued, religiously I would have been obliged to fight on behalf of the Kauravas. For a battle that there's no way I could fight on behalf of the Kauravas against the Pandavas. Krishna is very kind. He's relieved me of that, making that choice. Bhishma didn't have that choice. We'll come back to this topic later. So, therefore, he was fighting on the side of the Kauravas, but his heart, he wanted the Pandavas to be victorious. He told Duryodhan again and again, the Pandavas are invincible. They cannot be killed. You cannot kill them and I cannot kill them. Krishna is their protector. So, you're a fool. But you're my king. I'm religiously bound to a fool. So when the Pandavas were victorious, so Prabhupada explained this, that they wanted the cherished deep desire of Grandfather Bhishma to be fulfilled. And therefore, when they came before Grandfather Bhishma, they didn't just come walking across the battlefield. They came on golden chariots with golden bedecked horses and full regal attire and crown and opulence, and like Kuvera coming with the Guhyakas. Here comes Maharaj Yudhisthira with all opulence and with Krishna. It was for the pleasure of Grandfather Bhishma to satisfy his heart. They came the way that they came. Seeing Grandfather Bhishma lying on the ground like a demigod fallen from the sky, the Pandava king Yudhisthira, along with his younger brothers and Lord Krishna, bowed down before him. This is Krishna again. Bhishma has already glorified, he is the supreme personality of Godhead. Do you know what this means? He is the cause of the whole creation. And then he enters within the whole of creation, within the heart of every one of us in this assembly. And here he is standing right before us. Krishna, the personality of Godhead. And here he comes paying his obeisances before Grandfather Bhishma to glorify Grandfather Bhishma. Krishna likes to glorify his devotees. It's a great mystery. We, you know, can roll off the tongue very easily, but when you consider what it means, Krishna, who is superior, places himself subordinate. What is it that Krishna is subordinating himself to? He's subordinating himself to the love of his devotees. The personality of Godhead becomes controlled by the love of his devotees. The supreme controller becomes controlled. It's not a control by force, it's a control by love. It should give us a little clue of what devotional service is about. we become controlled by love. Isn't it true? One can sacrifice one's whole life out of love for another. Literally, the risk of life and one's whole life energy out of love for another. People do this in this world out of attachment and call it love. What to speak of spiritual love that has no material taint? That's the platform that Bhishma Dev was on. And when Bhishma Dev was prepared to give up his body, Krishna came before him, bowed before him like a subordinate. Krishna liked that very much. Just to see the chief of the descendants of King Bharat, Bhishma, all the great souls in the universe, namely the rishis amongst the demigods, brahmanas and kings, all situated in the quality of goodness, were assembled there. Prabhupada makes the point. It's not only renunciates, sannyasis, who are transcendentalists in the quality of goodness. Many of them were householders. All the great sages like Parvat Muni Narada Domya Vyas wasn't a renunciate. Bhadrashva, Bharadvaj, Parashara, Parashuram, Vashishta, Indra Pramada, Trita, Gutsamada, Asita, Kashivan, Gautama, Atri, Kaushika, and Sudarshan were present. What an entourage. And they all came because they wanted to, two things. They wanted to be present at this glorious occasion of the passing of Grandfather Bhishma and to bring auspiciousness to that situation. Both. So receive and give. One lecture at the time of, on the occasion of Bhaktisiddhanta's disappearance day, Srila Prabhupada explained that from a Vaishnava point of view, the gloriousness of the appearance day of a great Vaishnava and the gloriousness of the disappearance day of a great Vaishnava are non-different. Now there's different emotions, appearance and disappearance. And in one sense, one might think the disappearance means a great loss for this world. And it is. It's a great loss for this world. But it's not that the soul of that great personality ceases to exhibit its influence, just like the setting of the sun means somewhere the sun is rising. And the rising of the sun means somewhere the sun is setting. The presence of the sun is it gives light. The presence of a great personality is they give spiritual benediction just by being, just by existing. So it's glorious or glorious or varieties of glorious, but all glorious. So, like the passing of Haridas Thakur, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu held a grand celebration. Like it was, you know, a festival in honor of Haridas Thakur. So the passing of Grandfather Bhishma is a grand festival. Not like, hey, he's going to leave, let's have a party. Glorious. Personality is glorious. And whatever he does, and these very significant events of life, they're cause for great glorification. And many others like Shukadeva Goswami and others, Kashyapa, Angirasa and others, all accompanied by their respective disciples arrived there Shukadeva Goswami. Bhishma Dev, who was the best amongst the eight Vasus, we'll hear more about this on Sunday, received and welcomed all the great and powerful rishis who were assembled there, for he knew perfectly all the religious principles according to time and place. Now, how did he receive all the great rishis and great personalities? Because he's stuck, literally, pierced by arrows. So there, with receiving a guest or a great personality, there are certainly external gestures one can extend. But if external gestures are extended and the consciousness behind those gestures is missing, it's very shallow. Conversely, in Grandfather Bhishma's case, he was unable physically to extend those gestures. But his consciousness was there. And that was extended. Appropriate words, his deep feelings, all of that was offered to such a degree that everyone was completely satisfied. And it's important when it's a fundamental part of Vedic culture when a guest comes to your home or comes to where you are to receive them, right? The injunction within the Vedas is if an unknown person comes to your door, this is specifically for householders. See a few householders here in the audience. If an unknown person, a stranger, comes to your door, what to speak of a rishi and great sage, if an unknown person comes to your door, they should be received as if they are Narayan. Because who knows, they may be. And the culture is, that's how they should be treated. And Narayan will be pleased when you do like that. And that's the reason for doing, because the Supreme Lord will be pleased with great formality, sincerity, joy, submission, service, but to speak of great personality, known great personalities. So, Bhishma was expert, and everyone felt completely satisfied. Lord Sri Krishna is situated in everyone's heart. Yet, he manifests his transcendental form by his internal potency. This very Lord is sitting before Bhishma Dev. And since Bhishma Dev knew of his glories, he worshipped him duly. Bhishma Dev understood what was going on. He understood the heart of the Pandavas, which was to satisfy the heart of Bhishma. And he knew the heart of Krishna, which was to satisfy the heart of Bhishma Dev, because that's the heart of Bhishma Dev, is to satisfy Krishna. When there's intimacy in relationship, one understands the heart of another. And when there's intimacy of relationship, one understands how to please the other. Krishna came to satisfy the desire of Bhishma. Krishna knew that it was time for Bhishma Dev to give up his body, and Bhishma Dev had one topmost desire, and that was at the time of giving up his body to see the face of Krishna, to fix his senses, his full concentration upon the transcendental form of Krishna when giving up his body. So Krishna came. You didn't even have to call him. Draupadi had to call him. Bhishma didn't even have to call him. And when Krishna came, Bhishma Dev worshipped him. Now he didn't have the paraphernalia, didn't have, couldn't get up and about. But he worshipped him from the core of his heart, which is when we're doing worship, we may be able to get up and about. And so many circles with the incense and the giva, we can do our ritual, but the essence of the ritual is far more important, although it doesn't mean we don't do the ceremonial function. What Krishna wants is the love behind the object that we're offering, or the act of making some offering. He doesn't need a flower and some water. Got lots of flowers and lots of water, etc. Love and devotion Krishna wants. Bhishma knew how to offer love and devotion to Krishna. He worshipped him with his full love and devotion. The sons of Maharaj Pandu were sitting silently nearby, overtaken with affection for their dying grandfather. Seeing this, Bhishma Dev congratulated them with feeling. There were tears of ecstasy in his eyes, for he was overwhelmed by love and affection. Now here he is in his deathbed, and just to see the beloved sons of Pandu, just to see them in this situation, finally, the desire of Krishna has been completed. Again, the ruling of the whole world is in their hands. Ecstasy. Not like victory. Ecstasy. And love. This is the fruit of Krishna consciousness. Feelings that people just otherwise don't know. Krishna has been pleased. And the result of Krishna being pleased that he is defeated. Ecstasy. He's on his deathbed. Ecstasy. Whatever, if Krishna is pleased, ecstasy. Joy, tears of joy. In the spiritual world, there's no envy. The other day I was asked a question, an honest question, one of those special questions that's honest. I struggle a lot. When I hear the ideas of increasing devotion, I get inspired. But when I see another person making more advancement than me and getting honor and recognition more than me, something happens. It's envy. And what do I do, Maharaj? That position of envy is absent in the heart of a devotee. It's just in our ordinary dealings. If we could center on Krishna should be pleased, and somebody over here pleases Krishna, somebody over there pleases Krishna, all around us there are persons pleasing Krishna. Hey, that's great. Krishna's pleasure is increasing. Hare Bol. How wonderful. Let me associate now with these capable of pleasing Krishna personalities, and maybe a little of that ability to please Krishna will rub off on me. It's a double benefit. Krishna's pleased, and I'll have great association. I'm so fortunate. That's the heart of a person who's non-envious. Now, Prabhupada used this phrase, he called it transcendental competition. Like amongst the gopis. It wasn't if one gopi pleased Krishna, oh, she pleased Krishna. But it would be, let me see what I can do to also increase the pleasure of Krishna. This other gopi has inspired me. Let me see what I can do to also please Krishna. Prabhupada called that transcendental competition. Not the other kind. The worldly competition is if somebody is success. If somebody wins, then I lose. But transcendental competition is somebody wins, we all win. And if we all win, then if we all are pleasing Krishna, we leave behind the material world, which is what Krishna wants us to do. Krishna wins. Grandfather Bhishma knew no envy. He knew the happiness of Krishna to the degree that he was just overwhelmed with ecstasy. Tears of ecstasy were flowing from his eyes. And while he's in his position on his deathbed, and it's not like he described, it comes out in Mahabharata more than here in Srimad Bhagavatam, but one can only imagine, he was feeling pain by those arrows piercing his body. He was a yogi, but it's not like it's not like he didn't know that there was pain. I had an interesting discussion with Hari Sori. Some of you know who Hari Sori is, at least you've read his Transcendental Diary. He was Prabhupada's servant for a long time, and I was discussing, not specifically in relation to Grandfather Bhishma, but the whole subject matter of Prabhupada's transcending pain. He's amazing. He just went on for like 20 minutes of giving example after example after example of pain. I'll give you a few of them. Prabhupada, when he would take prasadam, he would sit on a little mat, and he would have a little table in front of him, and the prasadam would be placed on the table, and the prasadam removed, and then he would go wash his hands and mouth. So in one particular situation, the best of my memory was Lajpat Nagar temple in Delhi. Prabhupada was sitting, taking prasadam. There was a little table, and in a nimble way, Prabhupada stood on the table. After the plate was taken up, he stood on the table. And then he took a step heading towards the place where he would wash his hands, and there was some water on the floor, and as Hari Sori described, his foot slipped, his whole body went up in the air, and he landed right in his back on the side of the table. Pow! He said, it was a very large sound. Prabhupada didn't make a sound. He looked this way, he looked that way, and he got up and went and washed his hands. He's, you know, Prabhupada's 80 years old at that time. Another time, Prabhupada had an abscess tooth. Abscess tooth, like infected tooth. You know what it's like when you get a toothache. It was swollen. And Hari Sori asked Prabhupada, do you want to go to a dentist? Maybe he can help treat the tooth. And Prabhupada said, if they looked in my mouth, they would want to remove everything. No dentist. Just tolerated it. The theme of what Hari Sori was telling you is that Prabhupada just tolerated pain. Some days later, the swelling had gone down, and Hari Sori commented, Prabhupada, looks like the swelling has gone down. Prabhupada looked at him, opened up the drawer of his desk, pointed to the tooth that was in the desk, handed it to Hari Sori, closed the drawer. No, just Prabhupada reached in, pulled the tooth out, or something like that. He gave a whole string of examples. We got into the discussion, Hari Sori is saying he's having a trouble with one of his kidneys, so he can't digest so well. He has to be much more careful with what he eats. And I asked him, is it painful? And then he went off in this whole direction. He said, I'm a young man compared to Prabhupada's age. I don't know if you all know this, but Prabhupada had one of his health problems, continuous health problems, was We normally have two kidneys. Prabhupada had one that was functioning and one that was not functioning. The one that was functioning had a uric acid problem. So periodically, his hands and his feet would swell. Like, you know, like when you have a... And he just tolerated it. We didn't know it, but his servants knew it. And part of the massage was to help the swelling of his body go down and relieve the fluids that were in his body. Because it was painful. He just tolerated it. He said every now and then, unless he had an extreme case of difficulty, he would just go on with his translating and his schedule and his just, you know, this intense schedule that he kept, just tolerating the pain. So one time at 1:30 in the morning, Prabhupada had this buzzer system. He pressed a little buzzer by his desk, and Hari Soi immediately woke up and came into his room, paid obeisances, and Prabhupada was just sitting there with a very grave look on his face, saying, "There's too much pain, I can't translate." He was disappointed because he couldn't translate. Not so much that it was too much pain. But it was, Hari Soi's point to me was he was always in pain. He just tolerated pain. Just was part of Prabhupada's transcendental way. He just tolerated pain. When Kaviraj that came to see him at the time in Vrindavan, when he saw Prabhupada's condition, he said, "It's impossible that he's conscious," because Prabhupada had stopped eating, and he used the word flesh, means, you know, the muscle was gone. So it was nerves pressing directly on the bone, which is extremely painful. When people have that kind of condition, they pump them full of morphine because it's just too painful. Prabhupada refused any of that stuff, and he went on like there was no pain. He just tolerated. He had his capacity, like Grandfather Bhishma, to just transcend pain. Next time you have a little ache or pain, you can think of Grandfather Bhishma and Srila Prabhupada. And you withdraw consciousness. The method is this. You withdraw consciousness from the temporary, you invest consciousness in the eternal. Specifically, in Krishna. So, while Grandfather Bhishma is in pain, and the Pandavas are there, he's in ecstasy. And his words show his concern for the suffering of the Pandavas. Compassion. Compassion that places selfishness, it just doesn't exist. There's this word, narcissism, where one is completely self-centered, and everyone in this world that's not Krishna conscious, the body and that misconception of self is at the center of consciousness. That's I am. And then there's mine. And material consciousness has all kinds of conflicts because there's so many centers that clash. And Krishna consciousness, there's no clash. Because there's only one center. Although there's individuality, there's one center. I'll give this little example and then I'll stop. Prabhupada one of the first classes I heard Srila Prabhupada give. I couldn't understand his accent, so I had to listen to the class afterwards about 10 times. But it was a very sublime example, especially how Prabhupada presented it. With his hand, he created a pond. He says, imagine in the middle of a room here, there's a pond, and we give each person a pebble. And then I'll ask one of you, you place your pebble in the pond, and what will happen? It will hit the water, and concentric circles will expand. And then another, you place your pebble in the water, please. And it hits the water, boop, and concentric circles expand. And everything's fine until those concentric circles collide with the other concentric circles, and then there's a clash. And then on the count of three, everyone throw your pebble into the pond. And it's a big mess. But then, instead, we take one place, and each person places their pebble in that one place. And what happens? All the concentric circles amplify. No clash. This is Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada said. We have our individuality, and we repose our individuality upon Krishna. It's not an arbitrarily chosen, let's make something our center. It's our true center. And place our individuality on the true center. There's no clash. There's no competition. There's no envy. There's no conflict. And if another is in difficulty, even I may be experiencing some difficulty. First is compassion. Selflessness. Selfishness is the consciousness of material existence, and selflessness is the consciousness of spiritual existence. So Bhishma Dev, the first words he utters are compassion for the Pandavas. Oh, what terrible sufferings and what terrible injustices you good souls suffer for being the sons of religion personified. You did not deserve to remain alive under those tribulations. Yet you are protected by the Brahmanas, God, and religion. More on this in our next class. Bhishma Dev is going to take us down the path of pacifying the mind of a good soul, when that good soul may be troubled because of circumstances. It's a very nice section, very important section, because we're all, as devotees, we will time and again in our life be called upon in different ways, in different degrees, different circumstances, but be called upon to bring solace to others. Count on it, because it will happen. It happens. And how Grandfather Bhishma brings solace to the mind of the high-minded, high-virtued Maharaj Yudhisthira is very valuable. Very valuable indeed. So, 9 o'clock. Very late. Any comments or questions from anyone? Yeah.
Maharaj, you mentioned that Krishna is, Krishna accepts the consciousness behind, the love behind the object.
Let's try it again. Krishna accepts the consciousness of his devotee.
Behind the service.
Behind the service we render, yes.
So, when you do the service, you try to, develop and do it in that consciousness. But, sometimes it becomes artificial because we hear this so many times and we have to put that consciousness in just that, imagine something or if it, unless it is spontaneous, we don't feel much. So how do we know we are really
Everything has to, Krishna consciousness is a cultivation. So you begin somewhere. And even if it may feel awkward. If your practicing is not for getting some attention over here or over there, but for purification, to come to that genuine state of consciousness, keep going. Just like anything, when you first started playing mridanga, it was awkward. Or first time you learned to ride a bicycle. First time anything. But just by practice and practice and practice and practice and practice and practice, then it becomes, and then you can play mridanga that's just, you know, mechanical. And it's not the same as when you put your heart. So, similarly with doing something, you know, you can, one can be a pujari that makes all kinds of, you know, gestures just by practice. What's wanted really is the consciousness. You practice that, and it becomes, just becomes second nature. Not mechanical second nature, it becomes your consciousness. For so long we've been in the other kind of consciousness. So it's to be expected it'll take some time to get out of that consciousness into sincere, genuine Krishna consciousness. That's okay. But your question was, how do I tell? That's like saying, Prabhupada was asked, how do we know that we're sincere? And Prabhupada's answer was, everybody knows what sincerity is, and everybody knows what insincerity is. So, be sincere. That's the price for Krishna consciousness. Rupa Goswami's teaching. That you eagerly want that. I may be so far from there, but I want that. Even the question itself, that's a sincere question. I want the genuine thing. And I know what's the difference between just making a show and the genuine thing, and I'm not there. But I want the genuine thing. So then bring that sincere desire to the laboratory of life. And when you're chanting your rounds, and when you're doing your seva at the temple, when you're studying Bhagavad Gita, when you're singing in kirtan, not just so that it sounds nice, from your heart. So that the deity is pleased by the offering from your heart, not just the tone quality of your voice, or the beat on the drum, or the whatever it is that you're doing. Genuine devotion. And you feel that when it's there, and you feel when it's not there, too. We all know what that is. Cultivate that. And then it becomes more natural. Something else? I'm glad we don't have to do the translation part. Something? No? I thought I saw your hand coming up before. Okay. Yes.
Krishna Vishnudev is supposed to fight on behalf of his kingdom.
Yeah.
But he the wicked man set on the road.
Yes.
Why he been killing them beforehand? Why is he voluntarily came to after doing that? He who believe Because they are
weak. Wicked.
So why?
Well, I think we need to leave that up to Bhishma. No, that he's the Mahajan and he knows how to adjust things. He was there to give direction. There were many, many times when he was called upon to give direction. Just like after the gambling, when it was time for the Pandavas' exile to be over, and their 1 year of incognito was over, he and Drona and Kripacharya they were like ministers to the king, to Dhritarashtra. And they held their discussions, and they determined, now is the time for us to prepare ourselves to welcome the Pandavas back. And they delivered that message to Dhritarashtra. So, for example, and you know, other things happened after that, but they were in that position as the upholders of religious instruction. That was their duty. And, you know, so how does one adjust that duty with other duties and other duties and other duties? And that's what makes Dharma very complex. There's this, but then there's that, but then there's that, but then there's that, but then, whoo, and I get dizzy just considering all those things. So, my understanding is that was his prime duty. And he stuck to that prime duty. Then there's another way of looking at all of this. And to understand such a great personality as Grandfather Bhishma, one has to look at the spiritual side of things. He's a pure devotee. And pure devotees only do what Krishna indicates for them to do. And Krishna had certain desires. So, Krishna doesn't need Bhishma to be on their side to be victorious over the Kauravas. Krishna wanted to show virtue prevails over vice. And even a good person who supports vice will be defeated. So, Bhishma was the fall guy. Bhishma was part of Krishna's plan. And moreover, a more esoteric and in one sense relishable feature is Grandfather Bhishma's, try to follow this, Grandfather Bhishma's rasa with Krishna was dasya rasa. There's five mellows. His was servitorship. In that mood of servitorship, he wanted to please Krishna, serve Krishna by being, by giving a good fight. Because Krishna has that chivalrous secondary rasa. So, to give him a good fight, Grandfather Bhishma took that position. We'll find later in the chapter, when the sun starts moving in the northerly direction, he's fixing his mind upon his full consciousness upon Krishna. Where does his mind go? His mind goes to that scene on the battlefield where Krishna is charging him with the raised broken chariot wheel of Arjuna. That's the ecstasy of Grandfather Bhishma in the mood of dasya rasa, with the secondary chivalrous rasa predominating over the dasya rasa. That's Bhishma's ecstasy, which means it's Krishna's ecstasy. That more important than my word of honor is the protection of my devotee. And the protection of my devotee means smashing Grandfather Bhishma, so be it. The end of the day, the conch blew. It was over. Grandfather Bhishma didn't get smashed. But it's rasa. But how can that happen if Grandfather Bhishma is not on the other side? So Grandfather Bhishma is on the other side for Krishna's pleasure. How can a pure devotee act otherwise? How does a pure devotee understand what's Krishna's pleasure? That's something we're going to have to wait to find out. You can ask Grandfather Bhishma. And other pure devotees. And we get indication, like Bhima got the indication from Bhishma, don't draw your sword against Shishupal. Because then Krishna released the Sudarshan Chakra. So Krishna wanted to do it himself. In some cases Krishna wants his devotee to do, in some cases Krishna wants to do. Grandfather Bhishma understand Krishna wants to do, put your sword away. It takes great faith. To sort out these things, it takes great faith. And one who doesn't have great faith gets bewildered. Why this? And so forth. But I find people in that kind of dilemma. They get constipated. They can't go anywhere. They become faithless. Now Krishna doesn't want them to be faithless. He wants them to be faithful, and so he creates situations that awakens a deeper kind of faithfulness. From this chapter, it's very clear, Bhishma is a pure devotee. He can't do anything other than what Krishna wants. We may not understand. He says to Yudhisthira, even great sages cannot understand the purpose of Krishna. So don't you try. That's not what your responsibility is. Here's what your responsibility is. And he outlines his responsibility. And by entering in service to Krishna with that great faith, Krishna discloses. To the degree that one knows for certain, beyond a shadow of doubt, and the person that doesn't have that faith, all they know is doubt. Or they're just dull. They don't even think. They're just so covered. So there's principles of assessment of Dharma, and then there's rasa, love for Krishna, that's ruling over everything. Why did Krishna... So many things. Why did he tell Yudhisthira to tell a lie? Why did Krishna marry 16,000 wives? Why did Krishna call the gopis in the dead of night? There's different levels of understanding things. Why did Krishna have Vyasadeva write anything other than pure devotion? Why? You know. And there's answers, but the answers won't be understood without great faith. And so, part of this chapter is to stir great respect for Grandfather Bhishma, so that whatever he does, I may not understand the higher purpose behind it, but I'm sure there is one. And it's pleasing Krishna. He was able to give protection to the Pandavas from that position. He came to know of the intrigues in the royal palace, and Vidura as well, and from that position they could orchestrate protection. And one could take another choice. I'm getting out of here. These guys are wicked. State. Give protection. Anything else? Yes. In the beginning, should we concentrate more on purification, or should we concentrate on Krishna's pleasure? Well, why not put the two together? Concentrate on purification for Krishna's pleasure. And I mean it seriously. Purification represents goodness, and Krishna's pleasure represents transcendence. So when we begin any undertaking, they have this common, you know, popular phrase, begin with the end in mind. You've heard that one before, right? So Prabhupada explained, long before Stephen Covey came along, that when you define a goal, it becomes very you have a very clear sense of goal, become very easy to take the steps to traverse towards that goal. Conversely, if you don't have a clear understanding and clear conception of your mind of the goal, it's pretty hard to get there. Pretty hard to have the motivation to get there. What's there? So having a clear sense of goal is very important. Krishna should be pleased. But there's something that gets in the way, and that's our impurities, our attachments to impure things. And if I come, I want to come before Krishna and offer my service to him in such a way he'll be pleased. But I can't come unclean. I have to be clean. I have to be pure. So let me become pure, which is goodness, for the pleasure of Krishna. Another way of answering your question is, if your binary processor is called the mind, sees it's one or the other, it's a one or a zero, but can't be both a one and a zero, then it should be pleasing Krishna. Just like in Krishna consciousness, we have our four regular principles and the chanting of the holy name. Chant the holy name. And the desire to become pure by following the regular principles will follow. But we don't need to think, well, I can do one or the other, but I can't do both. The following of the regular principles may be tested somewhere down the line by circumstance. And how I'm going to stay on the regular principles platform is by my desire to please Krishna. The mode of goodness is supported and sustained by transcendence. But the mode of goodness also helps one enter into transcendence. So good companions. Does that help? Anything for ladies? Yes. How do we see everything? It's in a neophyte stage, to see everything as part of Krishna's plan is not going to happen. Because we're neophytes. So the neophyte stage is to follow Vaidhi, sadhana bhakti, and to place ourselves securely under the direction and the authority of those who are guiding our spiritual lives and trust them. And in the course of doing that, we'll learn so many things about Krishna's plan. We'll develop, like this just prior question, a little gradual purification will bring to us the qualification to have a sense of Krishna's plan, more so. But the frame of your question, in the neophyte stage, an essential part of Krishna's plan is that you place yourself under spiritual authority. That's a clear plan. Start with that one. Secure that very nicely. And then further details of Krishna's plan become known. Now, and it's not that, as Bhishma says in this chapter, it's not that one will necessarily come to a stage where what Krishna's plan is will be understood all the time. But that Krishna has Krishna is the controller, and Krishna does have some higher purpose here, some lesson. This is a good thing to always remember. In each thing that I experience in my life, in Krishna consciousness, Krishna is providing me an opportunity to learn something about him, about myself, about the relationship of devotional service, about a principle of pleasing him. Always, 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 always there's some lesson Krishna is providing. And that's a big part of Krishna's plan, is to guide us and train us, purify us. Trusting in that, I can go forward even though I may not know the detail of Krishna's plan. Because, in other words, what I'm saying is, more important is the relationship with Krishna. The connection. Than the detail of what's Krishna doing here. This is that I have a relationship with another person. If there's a fundamental trust in that relationship with the other person, I may not exactly understand why they're doing and why they're saying and why they're not doing. But I trust them because of very strong relationship. They're trustworthy over a period of time. What to speak of Krishna? So we're in back to the frame of your question, in the neophyte stage, we're out of touch with that relationship. So we can approach that relationship through those who are nicely representing and are more closely connected to Krishna than I am. Let me develop that as part of Krishna's plan. I can go a little more intimately and a little more deeply with my relationship with Krishna as part of Krishna's plan. And then the relationship with Krishna becomes more evident and more vibrant and more like ever present. And Krishna starts disclosing things. Prabhupada said, one day Krishna will say, I am like this. Okay. I think I'm going to end. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.